Okay, I think we're about ready to get started here. Just a little room etiquette. If we could all turn our cell phones off, try to hold the side conversations down for Mike here. And after he gets through, if you could form a line by the microphone there and try to hold your questions to a short period, we'd all appreciate it. This is the best dressed presenter in the convention this week, Mike Hoffman.
Thank you very much. I can't wait to tell my wife. She'll be very excited. So I'm here today to talk a little bit about a topic that really should have been rejected until next year if they had known where the conference was going to be for next year. Because this has nothing to do with Texas, but a lot to do with Chicago. So let me talk a little bit about William Hulbert, just a teeny bit about his biography mostly, but I want to talk about something near and dear to my heart as an economist, which is the impact he had on the formation of the National League, especially the business side of it. So let me just go on a little bit and talk about that. First of all, shortly after he died, a very early death, he lived to be 50 years old, the National League passed a resolution, and I'm not sure how many resolutions like this they passed. Certainly nothing as flowery as this. I just took one snippet of one of the final sentences in which the National League, shortly after he died, said, "We will honor his name and ever cherish his memory." If anybody out here knows one thing the National League has honored William Hulbert with, I would love to know, because I did not find anything there. In 1916, Abraham Mills, who was one of the successors of Hulbert as the president of the National League, and the occasion of the 40th anniversary of the National League, said that he could not doubt that all true lovers of baseball will always cherish and honor the memory of William A. Hulbert. And sure enough, when it came time to elect the original members of the Hall of Fame, they passed William Hulbert over and over and over and over again. And to this day, nobody has waited longer after their death to get into the Hall of Fame. 113 years after he died, William Hulbert was finally inducted into the Hall of Fame, after 20 other executives made it in before him. And ironically, he grew up about 15 miles from Cooperstown, and it took him until 113 years after he died to get there. This is not, though, about, you know, getting him into the Hall of Fame. Obviously, he's there. And it's not even necessarily about saying how underappreciated he was, but rather about saying how important what he did was, not so much because he thought of everything, but because he was instrumental in getting these things done. So let me just talk a little bit. He was a stockholder in the Chicago White Stockings before they even joined the National Association. So in 1870, Chicago, by this time, was a bustling metropolis. It was the fifth largest city in the United States, but largely regarded as an outpost by the East Coast. So the businessmen in Chicago, the people who'd moved there, the movers, the shakers, the people who were trying to make a lot of money, and particularly the people who were trying to build up the stockyards, really had this inferiority complex, and they wanted something to get more attention and gain more respect in the business world. They saw the attention that the 1869 Red Stockings had gotten. They apparently hadn't looked at the balance sheet to figure out that it was not a profitable institution. So they started their own professional baseball team. So in 1870, they hired some players. They wanted to broadcast Chicago with a good baseball team, and so that's what we have. So in 1870, William Hulbert becomes a minority stockholder. He buys 3 shares in the Chicago White Stockings, which then a year later joined the National Association, this fledgling organization. Here's a picture of the ballpark they played in. This is Union Baseball Grounds at Lake Park. Here's the Chicago White Stockings from 1871. At this time, William Hulbert was just an anonymous stockholder. He didn't have a place on the board. He wasn't involved particularly with the team. But he was a successful businessman at the time, and this is going to be important to the story I'm going to tell here. Now, a series of unfortunate events takes place in 1871. Mrs. O'Leary, listening to the game on the radio, gets excited with a great play. Her cow gets just as excited, kicks over a lantern, one thing leads to another, and not only is a third of Chicago burned down, but so is the ballpark. And all of the uniforms, all of the equipment, and in fact most of the players' homes, because they happen to live in that area of Chicago. So the White Stockings actually finish the season wearing uniforms that they borrowed from other teams. If you look closely here, you can see that several of them are wearing the uniforms of the Athletic. And some very nice chapeaus here. Player number four here is the one I like the most. He still looks like the flames are burning his house down, if you see the look in his eyes. They finish out the season. They actually finish in second place in the league, but they don't play again for three more years. Now, what's interesting is the Chicago White Stockings earned a profit in 1871 and 72 and 73, even though they didn't even field a team in the next 2 years. Well, that's because, in part, William Hulbert takes place. So I'll talk a little bit about what he does here. First, let me focus on what he actually sees going on. During these 2 years where the team actually didn't field a team, rather they had a field which they leased out. This is how they made a profit. It was a small one, but it was a profit nonetheless. During this period of time, Hulbert is named to the board of directors and he's put in charge of publicity. Hulbert recognizes that baseball is something that is becoming a big deal here. And he sees potential in baseball as an industry, as a business. But he recognizes that the current model that they've got is not going to work out. So the problems with the National Association were not revealed by Hulbert. It wasn't like, you know, he went into a mystic trance and discovered all these things. These were widely regarded problems. They're reported in the newspapers. A lot of people see these things. There's a lot of drunkenness, both in the stands and even on the field during the games. Gambling is prevalent to the point where at some stadiums, local officials posted signs that says, "Do not take anything that happens on this field as real. There's gambling going on. You have no idea what's going on here, so don't bother going in." There was rowdiness, again, both in the stands and on the field, fueled by number one and two above. Teams wouldn't finish their schedules, so they sign up for the league. The National Association, if you're not familiar with it, it was a group of teams. It was pretty easy to get in, as I indicate down here, $10 and a promise and you're in the league. You had to play each team a best 3 out of 5 series, both home and away, but it was up to you to set the schedule there, and typically what would happen is the teams from the East, you know, New York, Philadelphia, they'd get the teams to come out, they'd play their games, the season would be coming to an end, and they'd say, you know, going all the way out west and playing in Keokuk, Iowa, that's not going to be worth their time. Just forget it. So they wouldn't finish out their schedules. So 1 year, for example, New York played 81 games, and Keokuk played 15 in the same league schedule. Okay. So these are all things that Hulbert points out are going to be problems. The league is not going to be profitable, even though he sees a great demand building up for baseball. So the time here is really ripe if we take a step back and look at the bigger economy. If you take a look at this graph here, the line on the left is the average work week, number of hours people are working. The line on the right is the average manufacturing wage. Wages are going up. The length of the work week is going down. The country is urbanizing. We move from, you know, 3 cities in 1860 that have over 200,000 people to 8 by 1870. So just a decade later, we, you know, quadruple the number of large cities. The amount of urban population is growing. Expanding intra-city mass transit is making it easier and cheaper and more convenient to get to ballparks. Baseball is a popular, familiar, and accessible sport. This is an industry that any business person would recognize as ripe for growth and even more important for profit. And this is where Hulbert really steps in. As an experienced businessman, he sees that the environment is ready for this. What we really need, though, is a new way of organizing it. So Hulbert had been born in upstate New York, as I said, just a few miles from Cooperstown. His family moved to Chicago when he was just a young boy, started a grocery store. He cut his business teeth there. We won't go into the whole story about that. He went to Beloit College. I won't talk about how he flunked out of there. But he did become a successful businessman, not because of what he learned in school, but because of his practice. He eventually gets a seat on the Chicago Board of Trade. He opens his own business, he becomes a very successful grain dealer, and he has, for our interests here, some insight into what's going to be needed. So, shortly after he's named to the board of directors and then ultimately the secretary of the Chicago White Stockings, he comes up with a plan that what we really need to get this business organized is to get rid of the old league and start a new one. So he begins a series of meetings. In December of 1875, he holds a meeting in Louisville. Now his plan is to start a new league and get rid of the problems of the old league. Well, one of the major problems he sees is too many teams, poorly funded, poorly organized. So his idea is 8 teams in a league. He comes up with the idea that 8 teams are really it's the maximum number of players that can, you know, that are really out there that are good enough to play. Really, 8 teams turns out to be about the most that he could manage, that he could find that would fit in this. But he goes with 8 teams. 4 in the West, 4 in the East. And the 4 candidates for the West are St. Louis, Louisville, Cincinnati, and Chicago. So he gets the owners of these teams together and he explains his plan. Now, when he pitches it to them, he pitches it in a way that says, hey, look, this is the way we're being treated in this league. The teams in the East, the New Yorks, the Bostons, the Philadelphias, they treat us like the poor cousins. They don't come out here to play their games. They steal our players. They don't honor their commitments. They're the big cities. They've got the money. They're running us out of this business. So if we combine together, we can work this better on our own. We can get some of them, and we can write a constitution, we can form a league, we'll make it tough. So what he really does with these Western teams is he sells them on the fact that we're being mistreated, we're being looked down upon, let's start a new league in which we have an equal say and we're on equal footing with the other guys. Well, they think this is great. They don't know how it's going to work, but they think it's great. So they send Hulbert off to New York with their blessings and say, you know, you have our proxies, whatever you can get to. When he goes east, he tells a different story. Not a completely different story, but a different angle on the same story. So here he meets with the representatives from New York, Philadelphia, Boston, and Hartford, which is an odd choice on the surface, but I'll explain in a minute why this works out. To these guys, who have no chip on their shoulder, who the National Association is working just fine for them, I mean, after all, they're making money, and they don't have to go out west where they're going to lose money anyway, how do you sell these people on a completely new organization? Well, these people he pitches to their profit interests. He says, look, here's my plan. There's only going to be 8 of us, and I'm going to grant you something you've never had before. It's called geographic exclusivity. You, New York, will be the only franchise allowed in our league. What's so special about our league? We're going to have all the best players. We're going to have the best players. This is where everyone's going to want to go, and they're going to want to see it, and you're the only one who's going to be there. Geographic exclusivity and building a premier league means you have a monopoly on the best quality product. And every businessman understands that monopoly means cha-ching. And on top of that, we're going to create something that only an economist understands. That's a monopsony. That means we're going to be the only ones buying the inputs too, which is going to drive the price down. We're the only premier league. We're where the players are going to want to be because they're going to want to play against the best. Nobody else is allowed, so we're going to control the players as well. That'll keep down salaries. That'll keep down gambling. That'll keep down revolving. It'll keep all of our other problems out. So he sells the same concept to two very different groups of people by pitching very different viewpoints of essentially what's going to be the same thing. And it works out just great. Okay. In a minute, I'll explain why Hartford is on here and why Morgan Bulkley is important. He was, by the way, inducted into the Hall of Fame way before Hulbert was. These are the fundamental changes that Hulbert imparts. Now, again, these are not all strictly Hulbert's ideas, but he's the one who organizes them and drives them through. An end of revolving. In other words, one of the big problems with the National Association is in June, my player might sign, you know, in June, my guy might sign a contract to play with Boston for the next year. And by August, he might actually be playing for Boston because he decided he didn't want to play for me anymore. So this constant moving from team to team was one of the problems that Hulbert saw. It not only eroded the value of contracts that teams had, it also raised, you know, questions in the viewers' minds. Who's this guy really playing for? I mean, I already know he's going to this team next year, so is he even playing for my team, or is he not caring? You know, what's going on here? He also imposed an absolute zero tolerance for gambling and hippodroming. He also forbade Sunday games. Now, this was odd because Sunday is the biggest day for most of these players because the average worker works 6 days a week. However, as Hulbert explained it, we're giving up short-term revenue by giving up these Sunday games, but at the same time, we're doing what we're trying to evolve in number two up here. Zero tolerance for gambling, drunkenness, and rowdiness. Now, if we exclude Sunday games, we're automatically already buying ourselves some, you know, some moral cachet here. We're telling people, hey, look, we respect the Sabbath, we're not going to be playing on Sundays because we're above all that. It really helps if you're trying to eliminate the gambling and the rowdiness as well. So this drunken behavior was not going to be tolerated anywhere, not on the field nor in the stands. Okay, so that was the key. Then he implements several business changes, and these are implemented in order to maximize the ability to make profits. The first one is the separation of management and labor. In the National Association, the typical team was what we call a cooperative. It was actually owned by the players. Typically, the way it was run is the players would take the gate and they'd divide it up amongst themselves. Well, imagine this is going to work okay if you're in New York and your average draw is, 3,000 people and they're all paying 25 cents to get in. That's some decent money to pass around the players who happen to own the team. But if you're playing in Keokuk, Iowa, and 32 people come to see you, 9 of them bring a chicken as the entry fee, and the other 12 pay at 15 cents, and 6 of them are getting in free, every player gets about 10 cents to play the game. Which means that they're probably more likely to listen to a gambler who says, look, I'll give you 10 bucks if you just forget to field the ball when it comes your way. I mean, after all, these people were in Chicago, okay? Hulbert also eliminates small towns. The initial constitution says you have to have a minimum population of 100,000 to get into our league. We don't want small towns where nobody will come back and play because the gate's going to be too little. We don't want small towns where so few people show up, the team can't afford to pay the salaries, which means the players are more likely to be, succumb to gamblers. So how does Hartford, with a population of 63,000 at the time, get in the league? Well, the Constitution had a clause in it that said, if the league unanimously votes in another city, then we will consider letting them in. And Hulbert had already identified Morgan Bulkley as an owner that he wanted in the league because Bulkley had deep pockets and great political connections. He eventually went on to become the mayor of Hartford, the governor of Connecticut, and the U.S. senator from Connecticut. So his potential for political connections and the fact that his daddy owned Aetna Insurance Company and that Morgan himself had started a bank the year before were great reasons to have Morgan Bulkley and Hartford in the league. In fact, Hartford wasn't in the league for very long. They moved him to New York the next year, but continued to call them Hartford. One team per city. Again, that geographic exclusivity. You get the franchise, nobody else can be within 75 miles of wherever you set up home plate. Hulbert was responsible for increasing the admission fees. He said, we want to increase the fee to 50 cents. One, it's going to reduce the number of people who come in who are this lower element that we don't want to eliminate the drunkenness and eliminate the rowdiness. Two, we want to make sure that there's enough money coming in so that you can afford to pay your players. Again, so that they're not likely to succumb to the gamblers. And three, we want to appeal to a higher quality of person. We want to attract more women. What he really does is he takes the vaudeville model that had been started earlier, several years earlier out in the East Coast, in which they realize that by appealing to a wider class of people, lowering the drunkenness, the rowdiness, the fighting, you're going to draw a wider range of people. You're going to bring women in, you're going to bring children, you're going to bring families in, and that's going to bring a lot more money. So Hulbert copies that, does the same thing that they did in vaudeville, raises the prices, increases the quality of the offering, just in terms of, lower fighting, lower drinking, etc. And then he also does something that had never existed in the National Association, which, by the way, had policies that said you can't gamble, you can't, revolve, you can't do all these other things, but there was no enforcement. He argues very vociferously, as we're going to see, that every one of these points has to be backed up with expulsion as the penalty. So he establishes a reputation immediately. At the end of the season, Hulbert argues for and successfully convinces the board, of which, by the way, he's not a member, to evict both New York and Philadelphia from the league. The two biggest, most prominent, most important cities in the league, he kicks out at the end of the year because neither team finished their schedule. Everybody thought this was going to be the death knell, but Hulbert argued the opposite way. He said, if we don't kick them out, which is what our Constitution says we have to do, then we might as well not have a constitution, and we've got the National Association all over again. So he kicks New York and Philadelphia out. 1877, he begins moving Hartford into New York, adding a couple more teams. 3 years later, in 1879, a scandal known as the Louisville Four. I'm not going to go into the details. There's a wonderful article in the National Pastime a few years ago that was written on the Louisville Four, but it's about a scandal in which four members of the Louisville team were implicated for throwing games. He gives them all a lifetime suspension, so throws them out of the league. It's so devastating to Louisville that the team collapses and doesn't even field the team the next year. Two of the players had previously been sold to St. Louis. It's so devastating to St. Louis, they also fold. So kicking those four guys out of the league cost him two more teams, and yet he felt strong enough that he did it. And then in 1880, Cincinnati was evicted because they refused to buckle down to the rule that no alcohol can be served on the grounds and no games can be played in your stadium on Sunday, whether you're leasing it out for somebody else or whether you're doing it yourself. So they kicked Cincinnati out of the league. That ultimately is one of the linchpins that leads to the creation of the American Association later. But the point here is, Hobart makes three very difficult and controversial decisions at the time. In other words, he was advised not to do these things because it was going to cost him in the short run. And it did. However, in the long run, it pays off because 138 years later, the National League is still here. So Hobart makes several innovations here. Now, these are all things that Hobart either came up with or took the idea from somebody else and pushed it through. Territorial exclusivity, fixed schedules. Remember, when the league first starts, National Association, everybody makes their own schedules. Hobart realizes that's a problem, so he invents the fixed schedule. He says, no, the league will write the schedule. We will tell you when you're going to play and where you're going to play. You have to be there or we'll kick you out of the league. And that's exactly what happened with New York and Philadelphia. Uniform contracts. No more of these, you know, vague contracts. Every player has the same contract. You just fill in the blanks. Those contracts exist to this day. Roster of umpires. Up to this time, the umpires are chosen by the home team. This is obviously a problem. So Hobart creates, with the team owners, a roster of umpires in which we hire professional umpires who come in. And then ultimately the reserve clause. This is not Hobart's idea. It's not his brainchild. But if you look back at some of the letters he writes, he's already hinting at this in the early 1870s, this idea of players not being able to move on from team to team. The idea is actually put forward by Art Soden, but Hobart marshals it through the board of directors and the reserve clause is born. And the owners should have elected him, gotten him elected to the Hall of Fame very first, just because of the reserve clause. Hobart also beats off two competing leagues. Well, he doesn't beat off the second one. The American Association actually forms right after he dies. The International Association, however, is a competing league that's made up primarily of cities that were not brought into the National League, cities that were in the National Association. And he immediately moves towards those. He doesn't fight with them. He realizes the expense of a fledgling league trying to fight with another league. So instead, he moves in and he co-opts the league. He moves in, and since they were all smaller teams, and he already had most of the best players, what he does is he sets up a league alliance. And he basically starts to buy the teams off. He says, look, select cities out here will be allowed to be in the league alliance. That means we'll guarantee you games, exhibition games, against the National League teams. The premier players will come in there. In fact, Hobart refuses to allow any of these exhibition games to be played in National League cities. They will be played on your turf. We'll come in there. We'll guarantee you a certain number. You have to guarantee us a certain amount of the box office, a certain amount of money. We can cancel the game within 24 hours. If you cancel the game, you have to pay us the advance anyway. So the conditions strictly favor the National League all the way along, but he has the International Association right where he needs them. You need us more than we need you, and neither one of us wants to get in a fight. So he kind of co-opts that league, and he milks it like that, and after about 4 years, the league eventually fades away, but it was never a real threat to the National League. The American Association is a different problem, but by this time, Hobart is dead. Ultimately, of course, the National League survives the American Association as well. Hobart was also, by this time, a majority owner of the Chicago White Stockings. Not the majority owner, one of the three largest stockholders in the Chicago White Stockings. He's also the president of the Chicago White Stockings. He starts a new process of giving away free tickets to the press. He recognizes that publicity is a good thing, and if the reporters are given free entrance to the game, and they're given nice seats, and they're taken care of, they're probably going to write nice things about you. He builds a new ballpark. He built a new ballpark before he had a team, remember? He uses that as a revenue source. In the winter, it becomes a skating rink. He recognizes that a winning team is important. So he signs a few decent players, Spalding, Anson, White, all of whom have made the Hall of Fame. Why the Chicago Cubs to this day are always recognized as winners wherever we go. He puts together a fan-friendly stadium. He has seat cushions, he has luxury boxes, which have, curtains on the side so the sun doesn't shine on the people there. What he wanted to create, quote, was the atmosphere befitting of a genteel woman. This is the kind of person he wants to attract into his ballpark because he knows that by doing that, he will lift the prominence of his team. He'll give it a better look. He'll also reduce the amount of gambling and drinking and rowdiness, and he's going to get exactly what he wants here. So, the Hulbert legacy after all this, the National League is still here after 138 years. All four of the major sports professional leagues are built on the exact business foundation that Hulbert set up for the National League. They all began with reserve clauses. They all have territorial exclusivity. They're all built around fixed schedules. They're all built on these basic principles that Hulbert marshaled through, recognizing exactly what it was that was needed. And finally, the Hall of Fame inducted him in 1995. And here you see all the luminaries who came in ahead of him. They were all elected as executives as well before he was there. Thank you very much. I appreciate your attention. The National League. The National League put the granite ball there. This, by the way, next year, I'm hoping that anybody here from Chicago, this is a great stop next year because it's 15 minutes from Wrigley Field. This is Graceland Cemetery, and William Hulbert is buried there, and that granite baseball is the National League's, you know, that's what they did to honor him.
Look much better behind the podium.
I get that a lot.
My question, however, is about the stadiums. The era you're talking about, the railroads were building destinations so that people would, so they can build traffic. They were building Kennywood Park in Pittsburgh, for example. Of course, other places like that. Why didn't the railroads promote the building of the stadiums?
You mean the intercity railroads or the intracity railroads?
I think Kennywood was built by an intracity.
Yeah. In some cases, they actually did. For example, in St. Louis, the streetcar and the ball team were owned by the same company. And in Philadelphia, there was a deal with the Negro League team. I've done some work with the Negro League team, the Hilldale Daisies financial records. And there's evidence in there that they actually worked very closely with the streetcar line in order to get a streetcar built out to their ballpark that would run later in the day so that they could get people back from the game after it ended. So there was actually some of that going on. There was a very close working relationship between the streetcars and the baseball. It was a very symbiotic relationship. They both benefited from one another.
Yes, sir. How did Brooklyn come about? If New York was given X less service, how did Brooklyn come into the league?
New York was kicked out of the league after the first year, and then Hartford was moved to Brooklyn. They would continue to call themselves the Hartford team for that year, but they were moved to Brooklyn.
Brooklyn was a different city. Brooklyn and New York didn't merge until
1995. It was, but it was within 75 miles of New York's home plate. And that was they had a 75-mile radius of exclusivity.
Do you have a sense of where Hulbert did kind of die kind of quickly and suddenly. Do you have any sense of things that might have been different? I mean, you can't tell long-term or short-term for where he was headed in terms of, because I know some of the stuff that maybe he was opposed to started then creeping back into baseball, and I'm wondering, would he have been adapted to some of those changes?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, and historians love to look back and say, gee, what would have happened? Yeah, but that's true. Almost, he got sick in the fall of 1881, and he died in 1882, just as the American Association was starting its first season, and almost immediately his successor started to undo some of the things that he did. The prohibition on Sunday ball, the prohibition of beer sales, letting teams in the league that were, under 100,000, holding hard lines against people. It's hard to imagine, it's hard to argue with the success of his successor, in making those changes, but I can't imagine that Hulbert would have moved that quickly. He was very adamant about some of those things, and I think that those changes probably would have come along more slowly, but ultimately I think it probably would have happened anyway.
Any sense of why it took so long to get him into the whole thing?
He was the was the wasn't even the first president of the National League. That's the thing. Morgan Bulkley was the first president of the National League. That's the picture up there, the owner of Hartford. And that was by, almost certainly, that was by Hulbert's design. Is that Hulbert was the real power behind the league. He didn't want to go out east and, you know, say, oh, by the way, I'm going to be the president of this new league. In fact, one of the important things of getting the Eastern teams on board here was electing one of their own, Morgan Bulkley, as the president. There are some stories about how this happened, but, you know, when you look at the documents, it's pretty clear that Hulbert almost certainly knew that he wanted an Easterner in charge, and he probably had Bulkley in mind because Bulkley had almost no experience in baseball, had very little interest in baseball, but he had great political connections, he had lots of money, and he's exactly the person that Hulbert could manipulate from behind the scenes, which is exactly what happened. There are some letters in Hulbert's files which show that, you know, almost immediately after the league was formed, for example, New Haven wanted petitions to get into the league. They didn't go to Morgan Bulkley. They drove all the way out to Chicago on a train to meet with William Hulbert and implored him to let them into the league. Hulbert wasn't even a member of the board, and yet people right away knew that, you know, he was the man calling the shots. So probably because he kind of got forgotten about, and he really wasn't the first president, and ultimately Bulkley was one of the first executives that, you know, elected because he was the first president. And I'm getting the eye that I think my time is up here. So, all right, thank you very much. Appreciate it.